And I suppose the reason that Marina and I participate in this tight meeting is because that we do have 1.5 dozen children, all of our own. Now, I don't like for anybody else to say that, because sometimes they might not be able to distinguish between 1.5 dozen and 1.5 dozen. Now, there's a difference, isn't there? Well, we had, in the first 10 or 15 years we were married, 6, and then 10 years later, we had another. So we still had our original 6, and one more. So we say we have 1.5 dozen. Looking around to see whether or not my wife is present here in this meeting, it always cramps my style a little bit to have her present, because she knows what is pure theory with me and what is practical, and probably the rest of you don't. So I will try to present what I have to say as being that which is practical. But if she comes in later is listening, she'll tell me later which was theory. Now, on the family, we'll talk about here 3 relationships. The husband to the wife, wife to the husband, and the parents to the children. And then do some follow-through on this in a smaller meeting tomorrow. The book of the Bible, which probably has its greatest interest to married folks, to lovers, is the Song of Solomon. And inasmuch as love is such a strong human emotion, there are those who say that if the Bible did not give major attention to this subject, we might have reason to question its inspiration. Now, just as background, since we want Bible background, I want to comment a little bit on this book, the Song of Solomon, referred to 2 or 3 verses here. There are many interpretations given to this book, and you can take your choice of which one you want to use. I believe that the story here is a true story, and it's written because that it has a spiritual application. And as I understand it from an outline in the Dixon Bible and the New Amplified Old Testament, seems to give some credence to this view that Solomon, the king, had a summer home up in Syria, up at a higher elevation than Jerusalem. And so one summer, as he moved up to the summer capital, in the village close by, he got acquainted with, or at least sighted, the local beauty queen. Now, I don't know how they got acquainted. Maybe they were having a beauty contest, and he had the privilege of putting the crown on her as the winner. But Solomon had a good eye on him, and he decided that he wanted this young lady for his harem. And so he proceeded to try to make arrangements. The biggest complication was that she was already in love and engaged to another person. And so after he found out of her visit up to be interviewed, he was very much disturbed about it. And so she had to reassure him a little bit that this was purely an official interview she had had, and that she had no intentions of responding to it. However, Solomon took her by force, and she escaped. And one of the conversations we have in here is the renewal of their pledges and vows. Solomon, toward the end of the summer season, decided, as he went back to Jerusalem, he would have her taken into captivity and to go with them. And he did. And her lover followed her down to Jerusalem. And they had a conversation, probably through the gates of the courtyard or something. Solomon used everything in his power to try to alienate the affections of this young beauty queen to himself, and was defeated on every turn. And so in the seventh verse of the seventh chapter, we find his summary of his experience, and he said, "Many waters cannot quench love, neither can the floods drown it. If a man would give all the substance of his house for love, it would utterly be condemned." That was his experience, and so he sent her home. Now, if you want a real challenge in Bible study sometime, take the Song of Solomon, divide it up exactly the way that you would write a play. Identify the character that's speaking, the act, and the scene, so you will know who's speaking and where it took place. And it will really open up. Now, regardless of whether or not this is based on a true story, the conclusion is that many waters cannot quench love. And this is a true love story. For example, as the women from Solomon's harem were trying to persuade the young lady to voluntarily go, in the fifth chapter, in the ninth verse, they said, "What is thy beloved more than another beloved, O thou fairest among women? What is thy beloved that more than another beloved that thou dost so charges?" And then for the next 10 verses, she lets him have it. And she uses these expressions, "Why, he's the chiefest among 10,000. And she concludes that he is altogether lovely. And in verse 16 she says, "This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem." And so she really straightened him out as to why he was so superior to any other man that existed on the earth. And of course we have in the sixth chapter his description of her. And these are masterpieces in this. Well, with that as a background, to talk about these relationships and to pass on a few things that I've picked up and observed down through the years, some theory, some practical. It seems to me that as I have watched this relationship develop between a man and a woman, that there are about 5 stages that take place. The first one is an awareness of the other person. And there can be 20 people in the room, and the one that you have become aware of can leave or enter, and you just know about it every time. And then out of this awareness grows respect. If respect does not develop, then the relationship will not proceed any further. And then there's admiration, as you begin to see in the other person a little bit more than anyone else sees. And then it seems that affection comes along, and you become just a little bit illogical in your summary of the other person's great qualities. And then one day, when love fully develops, completely irrational. And from that time on. Now, all of these can develop simultaneously, but I had a reason for mentioning them. The abiding foundation in this entire relationship, which begins in the emotions and has a physical sealing relationship, but the abiding foundation is mutual respect. And I believe in every situation in which I have had the opportunity to counsel or be involved, a deteriorating marriage relationship between two people who have been in love can invariably be traced back to a lack of mutual respect. One of the couple began to do things or not do things which diminished the other partner's respect for him or her, and it's going downhill. Now, that isn't a major subject. I just wanted to mention that in passing. But I have one bit of advice that I give to the newlyweds and those who are not so new, and this is never, under any condition, criticize your partner in front of anybody else, including your own children. Just don't do it. And I've had people come back to me and say, well, how about in fun, in jest? And my answer is, there's no such thing. Because it really isn't jest. It's just something that you haven't had the courage to say alone. And so bring it out as a part of a joke. So, this is my suggestion, just never, under any condition. This will show that there is a lack of respect and of understanding, and mentioning it in front of someone else will greatly complicate the problem. So let me summarize this introductory statement here in saying that the abiding, lasting foundation of the love relationship is the maintenance of a mutual respect between the couple. And we could go on many, many hours in what this involves. But I want to be a little more practical here, if I can, and to tell you men, and then we'll talk about this separately tomorrow, what I think you owe to your wife. And then to tell you wives what you owe to your husband. And then to tell both what we owe to our children. So that's our outline here. I was in a barbershop one day and picked up a magazine, and the front cover was gone and the back was gone, so I don't know the name of the magazine. And something caught my eye that I still have, and I tore it off of the back page and kept it with me. I still have it in my file. I think I have it memorized. I don't know if this was a part of a story, but it was very obvious from the part I read that a newly married couple was having trouble. And the older husband, an older husband, was counseling the husband in one room, and the older wife was counseling the younger wife in another room. And so what I was reading there was the dialogues that had taken place. And so the opening part of the dialogue, as the older husband was talking to the younger husband, was, he said, she wanted to be told that you loved her. And so the younger husband said, but I was shaving. And the older husband said, I don't care what you're doing. When a woman wants to be told that you love her, if you have the IQ of a moron, you will do it. Then he went on to explain. And I'm not sure that I agree with this fully, or whether psychologically it's sound or not, but it illustrates the point we want to bring out. He said, we live in a big world, and woman is a very tiny creature in part of it. And it's her nature to be a little bit afraid and insecure with the bigness of it all. And he said, the only thing that cures that is one day a man comes along, he falls in love with her, and she becomes the most important person in his life and his world. So she's arrived. All of her heart, hopes, and expectations have been fulfilled. It's too good to be true, and she just can't believe it. And so because that it's so great and wonderful, and she wants it to last, she's suspicious of any little evidence that maybe this isn't true after all. And so she needs constant reassurance that she is the most important person in this man's life still. I tested this one day with a couple that had been married for a week. They were here. He and I were talking, and I said, has she asked you yet if you still love her? And he looked at me. He didn't realize anybody had been eavesdropping. And he said, how did you know? Not even a week. Well, this is what the older husband was telling the younger husband. You owe her the security of love, of knowing that she is still the most important person in your life. And men, they need reassurance by word and action. So we go back to the statement I quoted. He said, when a woman wants this security, this reassurance, if you have the IQ of a moron, you just forget about what you're doing and take care of it. So what do you owe your wife? The constant security of this knowledge of love and that she is important. Now, some of these others I'm just going to pass over briefly because of a lack of time. You owe her the security of leadership. Ephesians 5:23 brings out that as Christ is the head over man, you are the head over woman. And 1 Corinthians 11:3 through 5 brings out the same thing. I'm just going to hit two or three points in the outline and that I have here, and I'm going to dwell on two or three points at length. You owe her the security of consideration. And I want to read 1 Peter 3:7 from the Amplified New Testament. The security of leadership, which I wish we had time to discuss, but I think the others are more important. 1 Peter 3:7 in the Amplified, in the same way, you married men should live considerately with your wives, with an intelligent recognition of the marriage relation, honoring the woman as physically the weaker, but realizing that you are joint heirs of the grace of God's unmerited favor of life, in order that your prayers may not be hindered and cut off. Otherwise, you cannot pray effectively. But the security of consideration. Now, I'm going on to the next one here because it deserves more time. The security of communication. In 1 Corinthians 14, Paul had been dealing with a subject, something that had come up that, in his estimation, had caused a little disorder in the church. And so he devotes this 14th chapter of 1 Corinthians to this. And then after he got all through, he says, for God is not the author of confusion, but of peace, in verse 33. And then I think Paul, under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, had something he wanted to get off his chest for some time. And this just seemed to be the place to fit it in. So he tacked it on here. And he said, let your women keep silence in the churches, for it is not permitted unto them to speak, but they are commanded to be under obedience, as also saith the law. And if they will learn anything, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is a shame for women to speak in the church. Strong language. Now, I heard Dr. Jim Graham commenting on this once. He said, here's what he thought the background of this was. In many parts of the world, in fact, most parts of the world where you travel, you will find that there are certain churches, church auditoriums as you go in, And there's a six foot solid wall right down the center of the church. And as the people come into the church, the women file in on one side and the men on the other. And the women can't see the men, the men can't see the women. The person up on the platform is the only one who can see both of them. Now, in a situation like this, even today, but much more so on the day this was written, the men would file into the church, sit down very reverently on their side, perhaps pray or meditate on Scripture, get ready for the service. They had seen each other every day during the week in the course of their business. We're all caught up on current events and gossip and so forth, ready to worship. But the woman came in on this side and probably hadn't seen one another since last Sunday. And they noticed that one's missing. Well, now, where do you suppose she is today? Oh, well, hadn't you heard that she broke her ankle? Oh, no, well, I hadn't heard that. Well, who's taking care of the children? And so pretty soon, it gets a little louder. And so the men over on this side that are trying to meditate and be a little spiritual and worship are kind of upset by what's going on. And the pastor up here trying to start the service, he doesn't know what to do to get this shut off down here. So they laid down the rule. Let the woman keep silence when they come to church. And he said, if they want to know what the latest is in current events and gossip and so forth, let them ask their husband at home. He knows all of this. So as far back as New Testament times, wives had difficulty with their husbands telling him what was going on. They just didn't communicate. And so the only way they could get caught up was to find out from one another. So, husbands, we owe the wife the security of communicating what's going on so that she's a real partner in the family. And this is a constant problem, isn't it? But this is one of the things that we owe, and it isn't a new problem. Now, I know there's another verse over in Timothy that deals with this same subject. But I feel here in 1 Corinthians 14, this is purely a practical matter that Paul is talking about. Let's have the service orderly. If it isn't, it's the husband's fault because he doesn't tell his wife what's going on. She has to find out from somebody else. Now, just one other thought here. Over in Proverbs, the last chapter, on the godly woman, speaks about her children and her husband. And the verse I'm looking for here is 31:28. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praiseth her. Well, this is easy to do the first few years, isn't it? But later on, easier to complain than it is to praise. My wife tells me that she works cheaper with a little bit of praise thrown in. She works harder also. But isn't it easy to neglect this? But the Scripture says that as it's speaking primarily of the godly woman, that her husband praises her. This is a duty and a responsibility. Now, to go on, and I'm just kind of laying this out like a classroom, aren't I? So since we are, and we're a small group, now, why don't we just have a discussion here? So if you have something you want to say or disagree with, well, just go right ahead and we'll keep it informal. at least five things that the husband owes his wife. Now we're just going to talk about one that the husband, that the wife owes the husband. And I'm back again to my barbershop. Back page. The older woman talking to the younger woman. And she was telling her that she had a little responsibility in this too. She said, you know, a man is kind of an odd creature. He believes that he's kind of the Lord and Master of all creation. And anything he can think of, he can do. Just turn him loose. Give him a lever and a place to put it, and he'll lift the world. This is his whole attitude and outlook. But she said, all day long, he is in a competitive atmosphere. And there are people who are competitors who are sort of beating him down to his right size. So often, when he comes home at night, even though he has this world-conquering complex, that his ego has been deflated just a little bit when he walks in the door. And so there's just one place left where he can be the Lord and Master, and that's his own home. She said, now, if you join in on what the world's been doing to him all day, why, you're going to irritate an already bad situation. So just let him be kind of the Lord and Master and the big shot around the home, because that's probably the only place that he will ever realize this ambition that he has. Well, I think that was good advice that the older wife gave the younger wife. But scripturally, in 1 Peter 3:2, we have these words in the Amplified New Testament. I begin in the middle of a thought here, but I'll go ahead anyway. When they observe the pure and modest way in which you conduct yourselves together with your reverence for your husband, that is, you are to feel for him all that reverence includes, to respect, defer to, revere him. Revere means to honor, esteem, appreciate, prize, and in the human sense, adore him. And adore means to admire, praise, be devoted to, deeply love, and enjoy your husband. Ephesians 5:33 has an even longer list than this. We have somebody walking out here on us. However, let each man of you, without exception, love his wife as being in a sense his own self. And let the wife see that she respects and reverences her husband, that she notices him, regards him, honors him, prefers him, venerates and esteems him, and that she defers to him, praises him, and loves and admires him exceedingly. Now you ladies can see why I only said there's one point I'm going to bring out here, and that was Ephesians 5:33 in the Amplified New Testament. Well, what do the parents owe the children? Several things. We can comment very rapidly. The security of love. We know that this covers about every other deficiency. But on a more practical way, the security of discipline. That children need to know where they stand by consistent discipline when it's needed, which does not necessarily depend on how you as a parent feel. You probably saw the cartoon that came out several years ago in which a little child was asking his father, He said, why is it that when mommy gets tired, I have to take a nap? The actions and reactions of our children affect us different according to the state of our health and the condition of our nerves, do they not? But a child doesn't always understand this. Discipline needs to be consistent, not on how we feel. In 1 Samuel 3:13, concerning the sons of Eli, God says, for I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knoweth, because his sons made themselves vile, and he restrained them not. Eli didn't discipline his sons. Now there's a very important point here that I hope we'll be able to get hold of. Back to Proverbs again, which is has a lot of good information on child raising. In 2:26, we have the command, train up a child in the way in which he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. I've had a new insight into that verse here recently, and that is, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he was old, he will not depart from it. The indication seems to be that there'll be some difficulty in keeping him on the straight and narrow during the younger days. This is a foregone conclusion of Scripture. It's when he's a little older that he'll fully realize the value of this. In Proverbs 22:15, it says, foolishness is bound in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction shall drive it far from him. In Proverbs 19:18, chasten thy son while there is hope, and let not thy soul spare for his crying. And in 23:13, withhold not correction from the child, for if thou beatest him with the rod, he shall not die. But they develop pretty early a way of making us think that they're being killed. But no matter how much he yells, he says he won't die. Now here's the important part, 14. Thou shalt beat him with the rod and shall deliver his soul from hell. The preparation of a child submitting his or her will to Jesus Christ is a submission of his or her will to you. So discipline is very important because it prepares the child for salvation. In our connection with servicemen, we have many parents write, and they're really concerned about the condition of their child out in service, what he's done. Well, I've asked a few of them about the home life, and find out that the parent let the child have his own way, grew up and got in the service, never submitted his will to the parents. There's not any preparation, much preparation for presenting Jesus Christ to this person, because if he hasn't submitted his will to his parents, he's not prepared to submit to Jesus Christ. So when you discipline a child to where that his will is submissive to yours, as I said earlier, he's being prepared for salvation and to submit his will to Christ. We don't want to overlook this important teaching. Just a comment from Genesis 18:19. We owe the children the opportunity of development. Over here, God said to Abraham, for I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he hath spoken of him. I know Abraham. I know what he's going to do for his children, his household. And that's the reason he could trust him with greater things. However, I think the greatest thing that we owe to our children, and I believe is the area of probably my greatest failure, is example. And I think whenever I bring this up of Genesis 22, Abraham and Isaac, as they went up to Mount Moriah, at this time, Abraham was more than 100 years old, and Isaac was someplace between 18 and 30. He wasn't some little innocent lad that didn't know what was going on, but he was a grown man, probably physically superior to his father. I have a 19-year-old that I sure wouldn't tangle with, and I have a 16-year-old that's about able to get the better of me. And I'm not quite 100, almost. But Abraham had passed 100. So you remember that they left the procession and went up the mountain. And Isaac had seen his father do this quite a bit before. And he kind of questioned this, particularly when he built the fire. And then Isaac said, "Now, where's the lamb? Where's the sacrifice?" So Abraham said, "Well, the Lord's going to provide one." And he said, "If you just lay down here, Isaac, I'd like to bind your hands and feet and get close to the altar here so that after I get your feet and hands tied, that I can kind of ease you up on it." Well, Isaac wasn't naive enough to not kind of see through this. Particularly after he got his hands and feet bound, that he took out his knife. What was going on in Isaac's mind? He asked the question, "Where's the offering coming from?" And Abraham said, "Son, God will provide an offering." Abraham's testimony with his son Isaac was such that he had never doubted a word that he had said about what God would do. So I think that he wasn't even nervous as he was there, because he had seen his father's words come true so many times that he knew they would again, and he wasn't worried. I think that my spiritual example and teaching does not have that influence over my children. I tell them, "Oh yes, God will do this, God will do that for them." But on the basis of what they've seen in me, they don't have a whole lot of evidence to back it up. We owe them the power of example, because this will affect them more than anything else. And as we've made some analyses of children out of Christian homes, many of them who have failed, and we've tried to find out why. Now, this seems contradictory to what I said before, but very, very frequent, it's been because of a spiritual defect in that home relationship between the parents. For example, some busy day, you see a car drive up in front of your house, and you recognize who it is in the car. And you say, "I wonder if she's going to stop in here." "Well, she's heading this way, she must." Well, of all the inconsiderate things to do, to come at a time without this, without phoning, she knows that I'm busy, and take about 2 or 3 minutes just to kind of give her a little character analysis. And then about that time, she gets up the door. And you say, "Oh, it was so thoughtful of you to come over. I'm so glad to see you. Won't you come in?" "Well, I hope it isn't inconvenient." "Oh, no, it couldn't be inconvenient. You couldn't have come at a better time." So over here in another part of the house is 5 or 6 year old or a little older, trying to put this situation together. There is only one conclusion to which that child can come. And that is that mom or dad is a hypocrite. And a mighty big one at that. And they form their basis for their theology not so much on what they're taught in Sunday school or what we teach them at the family altar, but it's by observation and example that their theology is formed. So we owe them a good example and an authoritative example. Now, one more thought we're through here. Dr. Edmund of Wheaton College has written a book on revival. And in one of these, in one of the chapters, he quotes from Charles G. Finney, in which Finney has asked the question, when does a revival come? And Finney answers the question by saying, when two or more people get right with each other and with God, then revival comes. It'll break out. No matter what part of the world this happens to happen, two people get right with each other and with God. Who are the two people who then more than any others should be right with one another? It's a husband and wife. Now, I don't say that this is a logical conclusion to draw, but if it were, we could ask the question, at whose doorstep do we lay the blame for the lack of revival in the world today? We lay it squarely at the door of the couple who are not right with each other. And then with God. So there are great things at stake in our family relationships. And I know Pastor Ortland said that on the last night, the conference, he's going to have a wedding ceremony, a post-rehearsal, I guess you'd call it, or something like that, in which you go through the vows again. Well, as I say, there's more involved than just our own enjoyment. There are great spiritual issues at stake in us being right with one another and then right with God. That hand, it's got about a minute to go before it's 12:30. I think somebody raised a hand maybe to catch a reference here or something back here that I didn't respond. Do you have some question or comment you want to make here? This is a discussion here. Okay. Well, tomorrow will be split sessions. And husbands, I don't know what I'm going to cover because I've covered all I know and quite a few things that I don't know. The husband and wife. Where they both work. Yeah, it'll be one of the things we'll take up. And I'm not going to come to that meeting with the husbands with any preparation. So if you don't have something to bring up, it's a subject matter, well, we won't have any discussion. Okay? My wife will be in much better shape. She'll be ready for your wives. Let's conclude with a word of prayer. And Wayne Watts, would you lead us in closing prayer, please?